Ladies and gentlemen, I won't make any comment on that film. I think you probably have your own. It was a very difficult one to make, and I repeat what the reaction was in New York from the New York Times. It was sensationalist. See how you feel about this one. This is an Associated Press report from January the 24th this year. I won't read all of it, I'll just read a little bit. Fort Carson, Colorado is the dateline. A military jury on Monday ordered a reprimand but no jail time for an American interrogator convicted of killing an Iraqi general by stuffing him headfirst into a sleeping bag and sitting on his chest. Chief Warrant Officer Lewis Welshoffer Jr. was also ordered to forfeit $6,000 salary and was largely restricted to his barracks and workplace for 60 days. His wife Barbara testified that she was worried about providing for their three children if her husband was sentenced to prison. But she said she was proud of him for contesting the case. "I love him more for fighting this," she said, tears welling up in her eyes. "He's always said that you need to do the right thing, and sometimes the right thing is the hardest thing to do. It's tough to torture, ladies and gentlemen, believe me." Only, by the way, after six paragraphs are we told the name of the Iraqi general. His identity was not important to the reporter. He's Major General Abid Hamad Malhoush. But what's more interesting still, by the way, the conviction was negligent homicide, was the comment of Mr. Welshoffer himself. Earlier in the day during the sentencing hearing, he fought back tears. Everybody's crying in this military court. Quote, "I deeply apologize if my actions tarnished the soldiers serving in Iraq," he said. I could have thought of somebody else he might apologize to. We don't hear anywhere in the court whether the Iraqi general has a wife and children. We don't know how much they cried. You see, it's deleted from the narrative. The defense, by the way, argued that a heart condition caused Malhoush's death. I should think it did. Officials believe, you see, the officials are back. Officials believe Malhoush had information that would break the back of the whole insurgency. The man knew 40,000 insurgents, so he stuffed him upside down inside a sleeping bag. That's very clever, wasn't it? But you see the problem there. Even here, the inherent racism of this report is astonishing. This is the AP, but let me be a bit nicer to the AP. The American Associated Press news agency, with whom I've many times worked with their reporters, acquired in March of this year, through the US Freedom of Information Act, the transcripts of some of the grossly unfair drumhead military court hearings to which the Muslim prisoners of Guantanamo Bay have been subjected. In one of these, a British Muslim, Feroz Ali Abbasi, who has since been released, by the way, and spoken of widespread and systematic torture in Guantanamo, pleads with an American colonel, an Air Force colonel, acting as judge to be given the evidence against him. Remember, these are official American documents, the real thing. He was, after all, being told to defend himself against evidence which was not being revealed to him. Under international law, Abbasi pleaded, he had a right to know what the secret evidence was. The American Air Force colonel, acting as judge, then replied, and I am quoting from the official American record of the trial. He replied as follows, "Mr. Abbasi, your conduct is unacceptable, and this is your absolute final warning. I do not care about international law. I do not want to hear the words international law again. We are not concerned about international law." Which I think pretty much sums up President Bush's policies in the Middle East and elsewhere in the world at the moment. By reading you this astonishing quotation, I'm not making the obvious point that the American colonel judge is a disgrace to the uniform he wears. He is. Nor am I talking about what his words represent, the end of the American dream. I'm trying to understand what we should realize we're faced with. Over the past 3 years, ever since the International Crimes Against Humanity of September 11th, 2001, we have been complicit by our false denials, our sleight of hand, our fear of offending the world's only superpower, our growing culture of secrecy, Europeans, Canadians, many other allies around the world, we have been complicit in crimes against humanity, atrocities which stain our name as Westerners and which will forever be associated with us as a Western people. This statement can, of course, on this side of the Atlantic, in your powerful neighbor to the south, as we like to call the United States as journalists, it can be made to sound like arrogance. Who are we? We Europeans, who impotently watched the slaughter of 250,000 Muslims in Bosnia. Who are we to lecture the United States on morality? Who are we Europeans who do not force Turkey to acknowledge the genocide of 1.5 million Armenians in 1915 as a condition of entry to the European Union? Who are we to condemn America in its war on terror? Well, I'm sick of listening to any critic of the Bush administration being called anti-American. If I criticise our own dear Tony Blair and his grovelling to the Bush administration, no one calls me anti-British. When I condemn Middle East dictators and Middle East torture, no one calls me anti-Arab. Unless, of course, I criticise Israeli torture or human rights abuses, in which case a chorus of voices, often anonymous, accuses me or any other reporter who said the same thing of being anti-Israeli, or that most pernicious and slanderous of lies when directed against decent, honourable critics of being anti-Semitic. I am certainly anti-Bush, and against Israel's policy of stealing land for Jews and Jews only from the Arabs to whom it belongs, and against the cruel Arab leaders, most of whom were or still are friends of Europe and America, who have tortured and bludgeoned their people into submission. But what poses, I believe, the greatest threat to all that we Europeans and we as Westerners here today believe in, or think we believe in, is the sustained, savage, physically revolting policies now being carried out in our name by the American military on what is increasingly becoming clear are the orders of President George W. Bush, Deputy President Cheney, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, and the other super conservatives in Washington. The evidence which has been bursting out from secret and semi-secret American prisons around the world is of systematic torture and killing, of secret renditions to other countries where torture is routinely used against men and women. In other words, the illegal arrest and kidnapping without due process of any kind of men and women who will be stripped and beaten and raped and have been in some cases hanged or done to death under torture. I am not even mentioning the word Haditha. This has happened in the case of renditions after these victims have been taken to their torture chambers by aircraft which have used our European airspace and refueled at our British and other European airports on their route to perdition. So let me be frank. In Abu Ghraib, in Bagram in Afghanistan, in US military bases across Iraq, prisoners, almost all Muslims, have been tortured by American men and women who in some cases appear to have been sexual sadists. How do I account for the illiterate old man who tells me how American forces pushed a broomstick up his anus in Bagram and watched other prisoners endure the same treatment? How do I account for the murder under torture of prisoners in Bagram, something already admitted to, 6 cases by the US authorities? How do we account for the activities of US Unit 626, which has cruelly beaten its prisoners on the face, torso, and sexual parts? How are we to react to the 2 incidents, both now officially investigated by the US authorities, other than Haditha, in which American forces appear to have murdered Iraqi civilians? How are we to react to the American warrant officer who admitted in January, that same American warrant officer, to murdering in effect, but certainly to killing the Iraqi general? At the Baghdad airport detention camp, we now know highly trained US Special Forces officers, there were 1,000 present at any one time, have for 3 years been viciously beating prisoners before and during interrogation. Lieutenant General William Boykin, the same weird general who publicly disparaged the Muslim faith without being disciplined, later claimed, totally wrongly, that there was no pattern of misconduct at the camp. There was, in many parts of Iraq and Afghanistan. It does continue to this day. We don't have time to reflect upon the other human rights abuses and civil rights infringements. But what we must acknowledge is that America can and should be and has been a great force for good in the world. After the First World War, many American diplomats argued for the creation of one modern and democratic Arab state that would stretch from the Atlantic coast of Morocco to the eastern border of what is today Iraq. The British and French, the victors of my father's war, destroyed these dreams by carving up the Middle East into little undemocratic statelets which would do the bidding of our dying empires. After the Second World War and the powerful Roosevelt demands that the world should enjoy freedom from want, it was the United States which was the principal creator of the United Nations, which remains, along with the Geneva Conventions, or should remain, despite the antics of the Bush administration, the basis of our international laws and the most fundamental protection of our freedoms. And let us remember that during the Second World War, the United States of America came to the rescue of Europe and indeed to Canada, because your forces were fighting alongside mine, my country's,
True Soviet soldiers died in their millions to destroy European fascism, but if American soldiers had not died for all of us on the beaches of Normandy, the war would have gone on far longer in 1945, 46, 47. Many more innocent millions would have died, and those same Soviet soldiers might have reached the coast of France and Belgium. In Winston Churchill's brilliant description of America's sacrifice for Europe, the New World came to the rescue of the Old World. It is all true. And Canada, you, of course, who declared war along with Britain in 1939, were part of the Old World. But today, we are faced, I think, by another desperate challenge, to stand up to a rogue American administration which is destroying all this fine history and all the legislation which was painfully set in place to protect our lives and freedoms in 1945, which is fighting an ever crueler war in Iraq, costing the lives of tens of thousands of innocent Iraqis and ever more lives in Afghanistan. How can we Westerners, who lectured the Soviets and the Eastern Bloc states and the African dictatorships and, yes, of course, the Arabs too, about the need for freedom and human rights and an end to torture, how can we maintain our standards of decency and prestige when we remain such loyal allies of the Bush administration? It would be patronizing, I think, to say that Americans need to be saved from themselves. I hate those clichés. But millions of Americans, I suspect, need our help in ending the iron carapace, the shield which is now being placed over the free world. We Westerners can only help, I think, and can only dissociate ourselves from the horrors which are now being perpetrated in our name and in the name of democracy, or the babyishly named war on terror, by consistent, firm, and total opposition to the way in which George Bush and his government are destroying our political, moral foundations. Had international law been obeyed, we would never have supported the cruel regime of Saddam Hussein for so many years. Had international law been obeyed, we would not have illegally invaded Iraq and delivered its people into the supposedly democratic hell disaster which they now endure. We must refuse rendition flights, we Brits, through our airspace and our airports. We must, all of us, refuse to assist US forces unless their torturers are locked up and their military killers sent to prison. Insist that our military and political assistance is conditional upon the freedoms which our nations together fought for in the Second World War. Only in this way, I think, can we perform our most pressing duty. We should do so with friendship and compassion for all Americans, but also with absolute insistence that the United States must behave according to the rule of law rather than the rule of anger and torture. And our journalists have a duty to do the same thing, to make sure that these people are held to account. Because it is now, I think, the duty of the Old World to go to the rescue of the new. When Osama bin Laden so wickedly endorsed the attacks on America on September 11, 2001, all it needed to manipulate this crime against humanity into a right-wing policy of repression was for one man to persuade a nation that the world had changed forever. President Bush did just that. The world had changed forever, he announced, along, alas, with Tony Blair and other European heads of state. And so we Westerners began the long march down the crumbling staircase of our own post-war morality. Well, as someone who lives in the Middle East, among the very Arab Muslim population so patronized and vilified and threatened and occupied by the United States, and I say this as a journalist, I can only say what I've said before here in Ottawa, that I will not let 19 Arab murderers change my world, and you, ladies and gentlemen, should not let them either. Thank you very much for listening to me.
Thank you very much. We're going to take the question period now. I just want to make two reminders. There will be the book sales and the signing after the question period, right across in the bookstore. And of course, there will be the reception later on in the Tory building in the foyer, where there will be food and drinks for people that want to join and to chat with Mr. Fisk. If you'd like to, I'm going to explain how the question period is going to go. Professor Fisk is going to point you out, choose you, say...
No, you're going to put your hands up, and hopefully no one will, and then I'll say this and this.
Yeah, you're going to... Put your hands up. He's going to choose you, and I'm going to come to you with the mic. You ask your question. Please keep it short, direct to the point, questions, and hopefully we'll have a lot of them. Thank you.
Mine isn't a question. I'm just so happy to see you and to know there are people who feel the way I do. But I wrote a letter to the local paper and said I was comparing what was happening in Palestine and Israel with what happened in Germany and wondered why no one was saying anything. And they called to say they might publish my letter, and they said, I just want to say we're not going to publish that part. There isn't a paper in Canada or the U.S. that would ever publish anything like that. Are you trying to tell us that you see a parallel?
I'm sorry to have to disappoint you. If you're talking about the rise of Nazi Germany, I don't see a parallel, no. I don't think that what is being done to the Palestinians, which is cruel and wicked and against international law and is a crime, I don't think it matches up with the enormous, appalling crimes of the Nazis, and I have to be quite frank with you about that.
I'm from Iraq. Thank you very much for the speech, and that was fantastic. My question is, after 35 years, we live under Saddam's regime. As a Kurd, do you think what's happened now in Iraq or what's going on in Iraq, it's not worth it for the Shiites, for the Kurds? Constitution is written, democracy is there, president is minority.
No, just let him speak. Yeah, go ahead, please.
And yeah. We suffered from Saddam's regime for 35 years. He tortured us, he did all bad things to us. All I'm saying is not worth it now.
Can I ask you one question? Apart from Kurdistan, have you been to the rest of Iraq recently? And if so, when?
No.
Okay, thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, look, the reason why many people believe that Iraq is getting better is that because any journalist who goes to try and prove that it's not is going to die. It's that bad. The Kurdish area in the north, which I think in due course will become a separate country, which of course may indeed provoke the Turkish army to reinvade, when I think the Americans will not come to the Kurdish rescue, is one issue. But the rest of Iraq, from Kirkuk, Erbil up to a point all the way down to Basra, Bakuba, Amara, Samarra, Ramadi, Fallujah, Baghdad, of course, Najaf, Karbala, is a hell disaster of anarchy and chaos. If you want to know what it's like, last August, we're talking almost a year ago, I went into the city mortuary in Baghdad to count the dead. It's the only way you can find out how many people are dying. 9 by 9 o'clock in the morning, 26 by 12. I was counting them in, including a baby shot in the head, a woman with her hands tied behind her back, eyes taped, shot in the head. We are not allowed by the Ministry of Health, which of course is effectively operated and paid for by the British and Americans, to see the figures for Iraqi dead. But one of the senior morticians, an official who's been an old friend of mine for a long time, said, Mr. Robert, come with me, and took me to a computer screen showing the secret Ministry of Health figures for dead. And in Baghdad alone, in July of last year, just in Baghdad, and only July, 1,100 Iraqis had been done to death. That was last year, long before the massacre at Samarra. Now, even if you extrapolate that across a few cities, you must be talking of 3,000 a month, 36,000 a year. That 100,000 figure, which was poo-pooed by Mr. Blair, is probably conservative. The real problem now is that for most Iraqis, not for the Kurds, but for most Iraqis, they are faced with a terrible choice. What they had before was dictatorship, but security. What they have now is freedom and anarchy. And many Iraqis are saying, not in the Kurdish north, which is effectively controlled by Kurdish people. You don't even hear Arabic spoken in Kurdistan. You have been to Kurdistan recently, I'm sure. Yes. The Kurdish flag flies there. If I fly into Erbil, it doesn't say Erbil, it says Hawla. It's the Kurdish name for Erbil. It effectively is not part of Iraq anymore. That's something else. And I hope the Kurds get a state. They deserve one, including other bits which you ought to have. But the point is that Iraq as a major state outside the Kurdish areas is a hell disaster. To use Winston Churchill's phrase about Palestine in 47 and 48, you need to go there and see the fear of Iraqis to understand this. Is there really a civil war going on? I wonder. You know, I was at a funeral of a Sunni Muslim doctor who was murdered in Baghdad by Shiites, I think, Shiite gunmen, because he'd objected to the building of a Shiite mosque at the end of the street. And afterwards, I was invited to the funeral feast on sitting on the floor of the dead doctor's home. And on my right was his brother. Of course, he was a Sunni too. So I said, well, is there going to be a civil war? And he said, why do you Westerners always want civil wars?
I said, you know, I'm married to a Shiite. Do you want me to kill my wife? Because Iraq, as you'll agree outside the Kurdish areas, is not a sectarian society. It's a tribal society. They're intermarried. Somebody wants a civil war in Iraq. But I find it amazing that Shiites and Sunnis and Kurds, who could fight together in many cases against Iran for 8 terrible years, should suddenly want to kill each other. Who are these people who keep going to each other's mosques and burning them down? We keep hearing, oh, somebody was kidnapped by men in police uniform. 14 people were taken away and murdered by men in police uniform. Are you telling me that out at Fallujah there's a warehouse with 18,000 made-to-measure police uniforms? I don't believe it. They are policemen, and they're being paid by us. It doesn't mean I think that we are trying to murder the Iraqis, no. But something has gone terribly wrong, which we're not knowing about. And why is an interesting question, again, to ask. You know, all these various factions and these militias and these death squads in Iraq are all linked into the police forces. I remember in Algeria, during the battle between the Islamists and the pouvoir, the government there, in the 90s, we kept hearing about men in police uniform or men with police roadblocks cutting the throats of government officials. And it took us about a month before we realized they were policemen. At 6 o'clock or 10 past 6 or 17 minutes past 6, they ceased being policemen in uniform and became Islamists in uniform. But they didn't change uniforms. And this is exactly what's happening in Iraq, where the security services have been totally infiltrated by the insurgency and by the various Shiite militias, which is why the building up of the Iraqi security forces is not going to get the Americans out. I have to tell you that outside the Kurdish areas, I know of only one Iraqi man or family that does not now say, whom I know, that under Saddam they were safer and lived a better life. I have to say that the one family that said otherwise lives in the green zone, which is protected by the Americans, and only goes to the airport by helicopter and often goes abroad. Another question, ladies and gentlemen. Lady down here, maybe?
We have been devotees of your wisdom for many years.
Don't be a devotee of Fisk. Never.
Well, we are. We'll continue to be, and I thank you profoundly. But my question is, I'm interested in the response that you received in the United States. Were you given major airtime? Were you given the courtesy that you deserve?
We don't deserve courtesy, we journalists. We deserve sticks and stones, because then we know we're doing our job. Right, United States. When my book came out, I got quite a good coverage, but not, of course, on the main networks or CNN, but fairly strong coverage and fairly critical coverage, of course, in the mainstream newspapers. My favorite actually was The Economist, which is half American, half English, which after making some very snotty remarks about my new book, said that they did praise my description of the Israeli entry into Beirut in 1982, which was very flattering, except that that description was in my previous book written 15 years ago. So, right author, wrong book. But the New York Times gave it the cover of the New York Times Book Review, and Howard Gee tore it to pieces in the Globe and Mail, I'm glad to say. I wouldn't want it's Marcus Gee, isn't it? Sorry. I wouldn't want Marcus Gee to say anything too nice. In terms of public lectures, they were massive. You know, 17 years ago, I started giving lectures in the United States, and I'd be lucky if I get 30 people in Washington. Now it's unlikely in LA to get less than 2,000 or 1,800 in New York, etc. The reason is not me. It's because, I always begin lectures in America saying, shame upon you for inviting me. You should have invited an American journalist, but we all know why you didn't. And for someone who does not use email and hates the internet, I have to admit it's the internet that's changed a lot of things in the United States, because millions of Americans who previously were locked into the LA Times officials, American officials say, New York Times, news media, can now read the British press. And if they speak French, they can read Le Monde, Libération. And they're realizing that they're not being told the truth in the United States. And the reason people are coming to lectures there in such huge numbers, I get the biggest audiences in America than anywhere else, including France, Britain, or even Ireland. Now, maybe Ireland is about the same, but not Britain, is because they know they're being lied to. You know, they're not satisfied with Tom Friedman. I'm told Tom Friedman now demands $65,000 an hour for lectures. And as someone who doesn't charge anything ever, I can tell you I'd pay $65,000 an hour not to listen to Tom Friedman. finish off on the American. You know,
Americans are very smart, bright people, and that's why I hate this thing about being anti-American. I think Americans are great, but I think Bush is terrible. And I'm afraid that half of those people elected Bush, and probably regret it, but the other half didn't. Poor people, poor guys. The only thing I have which I criticize Americans, anti-Bush Americans for, is that the left in America is a very shriveled up, self-regarding, introverted institution. They all talk to each other and they email each other and they network between Princeton and Harvard and Berkeley. And I went to this intensely boring seminar in North Virginia not long ago, in which I was asked by various professors and academics of one hue or another if I'd like to attend and listen to them. So I had lots and lots of cups of coffee before I went in, and they were all talking about how can we get into the mainstream press. And I said, you're wasting your time, you're not going to, forget it, and stop talking about the alternative press. You call your newspapers mainstream and you talk about the New York Times as the alternative press as a start. And I said, the other problem is you just talk to each other. You know, if you want to have an effect on anyone, I'm not cheerleading, I'm a journalist, but it's, you know, if you want to have an effect, I said to Americans who felt this way, go out and talk to ordinary people. You know, when I give lectures in the States, the people who pat me down in security in JFK, I invite them to my lectures, and they come. I invite air crews to my lectures, and they come. I invite Amtrak crews and bellhops, and they come. But these academics in the States will not talk to ordinary people. They won't go to the truck stops and talk to truck drivers who are going to join the Marines because they want to have their education paid for, and they're going to be sent to Iraq. So the problem in America is you've got a very powerful government and an almost deliberately weak opposition. The activists, I hate that word, I don't think they want to win. I think they feel much happier saying they were right and lost. That's what happens in America. Yeah. Let's have a man now, because I want complete equality.
Apart from what elected governments do, what do you think of the influence, especially on U.S. foreign policy, of special interest groups which lobby for their policies? We've just had a recent paper by two professors who criticized it and talked about the influence that AIPAC, etc., have on the government.
Mr. Simon Walt, yes, I know. Yeah. Well, I went to interview Mr. Walt in Harvard 3 weeks ago about this very subject. He was a bit, I thought he was a bit shell-shocked by the response to his report. You know that there's two ways of responding to devastating and critical reports, on this case about the Israeli lobby. One is complete silence, and the other is the usual crime of anti-Semitism being shouted to the sky. They got both, actually. Look, Americans like to lobby, whether it's the rifle lobby, the gun lobby, the Israeli lobby, the smoking lobby, and there's nothing intrinsically wrong with that. What there is something wrong is the way in which the lobbyists have effectively, of all kinds, dominated the House on the Hill. I have a lot of mail from America, from the United States, more probably than from Britain now. And I had a letter the other day from a California woman who said, you know, I complained about what was happening on the West Bank to my congresswoman. And she said, thank you very much, and went off to Congress and voted another $6 million to Israel. I mean, it's like you don't have an effect. I mean, one of the problems at the moment all round, lobbies or not, and it comes up in all my mail from Britain too, about 250 letters a week, is people who believe the democratic process has broken down, that they vote dutifully as good Democrats, they believe in parliaments, and they vote for their MPs, and then their MPs don't represent them the moment they arrive in Parliament or in Congress. And I don't know how you deal with that. I mean, you can vote them out next time, but does one do so? We thought the Americans were going to vote Bush out last time. They might do today, but that doesn't count, does it? Look, the problems with lobby groups is that if you give way to them, you will always give way to them. One of the problems of the United States press, we'll take the example of the Israeli lobby, since that is obviously what you're referring to, is that there is a very carefully constructed system where any American journalist who crosses certain red lines in coverage of the Israeli-Palestinian dispute will be accused of anti-Semitism, and are, regularly. Instead of turning around and saying, to hell with you, our reporter is a decent, honest reporter, and he's doing a good job, and you will not slander him, American editors have a habit of saying, well, we're really very upset that you should say this. We're sorry. We're going to investigate it. I'm sure our reporter didn't mean this, et cetera, et cetera. And, of course, the reporter doesn't want to become controversial. So the language is toned down. I had a Boston Globe reporter in the Marriott Hotel in Cairo some time ago who was leaving the job of Middle East correspondent. He said he was pleased to go, and I said, why? He said, well, he said, my editors have got some readers calling him up and writing to him saying that the Likud government should not be called right-wing.
And he says, so my editor said, would you just drop it? It'll make life easier. So he calls it the liquid government, like the Labour government or Liberal government or whatever, you see. This was some time ago. He was talking about the Netanyahu government at the time. It's a big problem. Now, in Britain, although we have Rupert Murdoch, who's virtually destroyed the Times of London, which is one reason why I left it and joined the Independent, we still have The Guardian, we have The Independent. My editor, for example, will never give way on lobby groups or campaigns. He's revolted by them. In fact, he encourages reporters to tell it how it is. He calls our paper a views paper rather than a newspaper. This is someone who's got all over page one today and this morning, so of course I would say that he's a nice guy, but he is. He's a very tough character. And I always know that if I'm in danger in the Middle East, he's there to print what I write, and that's worth doing. But unfortunately, in the American continent, but particularly in the United States, lobby groups have a totally disproportionate and I think immoral power over governments, which they should never have. The arguments you know very well, and the Walt report, although it has a few inaccuracies, I think it's pretty good. The Walt and Mearsheimer, isn't it, the other academic? I didn't speak to him, I only spoke to Walt. That's the best reaction I can give you in a state of extreme exhaustion tonight. Any others? This gentleman down here, maybe.
Professor Fisk, I was told of a comment. I unfortunately missed your talk last time you were here at Carleton. I was told,
good, because there might have been some repetitions.
I was told actually by Professor Marlin that you'd made a comment about... an unequivocal comment about American military leaders telling you that had they received orders to go into either Syria or Iran, that they would refuse those orders?
No, that's incorrect. I've never been told that by an American officer.
I see. I was under the impression.
I think what I said at the time was that when the Americans arrived in Baghdad in May of 2003, we didn't know whether they'd turn left to Damascus or right to Tehran. Mm-hmm. But given the insurgency in Iraq, they're not going to turn left or right anymore. They're bogged down. That, I think, is what I said at the time.
Oh, I see.
Okay. I'm sorry. I think it's. I'm sure it's not my favorite professor's misquoting. I think you've been misunderstood.
It was a while ago, too. So I just wanted clarification on that, and if you had had any other information on that.
No. I do talk to American officers, but not much above the rank of major, because when you get to the colonels, you've got to be embedded, and I don't want to be embedded. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming. My comment is on the...
question or comment?
Well, it's a question.
Good. It'll be the same anyway, won't it?
What prospects do you see to what's called the prisoner's document that was worked out by Marwan Barghouti and other people in the jails of Israel?
Well, it's clever for several reasons. The first is that it could work, which is one reason why it probably won't. Secondly, because we know the respect in which prisoners are held. But, you know, I don't think there's going to be a resolution to that conflict. First of all, the Americans seem to be all out to destroy the Hamas government. We gave the Palestinians democracy. We wanted to have democracy, but the pesky Palestinians voted for the wrong people, didn't they? And I think Mahmoud Abbas seems to have lost so much credit. I mean, remember, Abbas is the colorless man who wrote a 600-page document for Oslo in which he didn't once use the word occupation. This is the same man we're dealing with now, and Palestinians know this. They're not stupid any more than the Israelis are. And I don't think that the present government in Israel has any intention of pulling that famous fence backwards. The Israelis keep saying, oh, it's not a permanent structure, it's a temporary one. It might be temporary so they can put it more forward at some point. But I don't see any chance with the continuing thickening, quote-unquote, expansion of settlements of any Palestinian state ever coming into existence. And I think for that reason that initiatives from Barghouti and his Hamas opposite number are going to come to anything. I don't think there's the will to do so. And I think it's a tragedy for Palestinians. I think it's a tragedy for Israelis, certainly for those Israelis who understand what this means. But you know, I don't know how you break out of it. I do know one way, and that's an America that comes in as a genuine middleman and actually sorts it out. But America is not going to do that. It's going to come in and call itself a middleman and continue to support Israeli policies. I actually, a few years ago, but I did it again the other day, I got the quotations from various American spokesmen for the White House, the Pentagon, and the Secretary of State. And I mixed them up with the quotations from the Israeli Foreign Minister and the Israeli Prime Minister. And asked a friend of mine in Ireland, actually, if he'd like to find out which one was which. He said, it's impossible. They're all the same. There's your problem.
You were speaking about journalism as freedom.
Sorry, I missed that.
Journalists as speaking the truth. I would like your opinion about our Canadian journalists who are being muzzled at the moment.
Well, I pretty much gave a fairly abrasive assessment of Canadian journalism in the last few days.
I think it's really... Hopefully the U.S. is coming out of it, but it seems to me that we are just falling into it, and that is the tragedy.
No, I think you're probably right. One more question, then I'm going to go and sign three books, because that's all you're going to buy. Your lady here, because she's been so persistent, yeah.
In retrospect, what military, industrial, commercial, and political doors were opened by the events of September 11th for the U.S. and its socioeconomic alliance, and thereby the U.S. to reinforce itself against its, as of yet, undeclared rival or rivals?
I've lost the mic. My PhD thesis will be with you soon. Okay, I'll be very, very quick, okay? I think they invaded Iraq, which was one of the opportunities that opened itself, because of oil. If the national product of Iraq was asparagus or carrots, the 82nd Airborne would not be in Mosul or Baghdad, would it? Number one. And the first thing and the only thing the Americans secured on entering Iraq were the oil fields and the Ministry of Oil in Baghdad, while all the rest of all the ministries burned, and the museums, and the libraries of Islamic art. I was on a highway, Highway 8, south of Baghdad some time ago, the famous throat-cutting highway, investigating the murder of a poor Red Cross driver who'd been killed by insurgents or by somebody. I was talking to an Iraqi family, and the whole ground began to shake. And up the road came this massive American convoy, bigger than anything I'd seen from the Soviets in the invasion of Afghanistan in 1979-1980. Abrams tanks, Bradleys, Apache helicopters overhead, Humvees, truckers, tens of thousands of line troops. It's the biggest roulement of military personnel since the Second World War. And the whole ground was shaking. I sat on the muck beside this Iraqi family on the side of the road. And I realized that, you know, 2,000 years ago, I would have been sitting in Lebanon. It would have been the tramp of Roman legions going by. And I think that superpowers, either in revenge for attacks upon themselves or by their nature, have a visceral need to project military strength. We can go to Baghdad, so we will go to Baghdad. Oh, we can get rid of Saddam. We will. And we will send our armies across the caliphates and the land where civilization supposedly began. And into the, of course, into the desolation of occupation. The British did it. And always they will say, we will never talk to terrorists. That's what they said about the North Vietnamese, and they talked to them in Paris. It's what we said about the IRA, and they go have tea with the Queen. And in due course, the Americans will talk to the Iraqi insurgency, not the Al-Qaeda. The Iraqis will have to deal with them. And indeed, I suspect they already are, and have reason to think they are at the moment, in Amman. But why did they go? I don't think they went because it was in Israel's interest, although it certainly was in Israel's interest. And certainly Israel was encouraging the Americans to invade Iraq. I think they went for oil. I think they went because they're an empire. And I was asked the other day, and this will be the final conclusion to what I say, by an Iraqi in Baghdad. And you know, when you go to Baghdad and talk to actual Iraqis in their homes or whatever, it's like looking through the famous glass darkly. And he said to me, Mr. Robert, can you tell me why the Americans, and he was talking about military bases, you know, helicopters, infantry groups, special forces. He said, can you tell me why the Americans are in Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Turkey, Israel, Egypt, Algeria, the special forces base outside Taman Rasset in the southern Algerian Sahara now, in Kuwait, in Qatar, in Bahrain, in Oman, in Yemen, still partly in Saudi Arabia. Why are they there, Mr. Robert? And in fact, there's an Iron Curtain there. And if you can take it from Greenland, Britain, Germany, Bosnia now, American base in Bosnia, Greece, cutting up, connecting with Turkey, there is an American military Iron Curtain now from the ice cap to the borders of Somalia. Why is it there? Why? Not one journalist, and not me, has ever been able to try and answer that question. But that's the logical conclusion. That was all taking shape before 2001, but my goodness me, it's hardened since. What's on the other side? China, India, Russia. I leave it with you. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.